Hi, it's Tony Bruschi. When you're not enjoying our haunting episodes of The Grave Talks, I invite you to check out our true crime and disaster podcast, Dark Side of Wikipedia, with new episodes every Monday and Tuesday. Just search Dark Side of Wikipedia wherever you download podcasts. Now, here's a 15-minute preview of a recent episode of Dark Side of Wikipedia. A man in search of new life comes to America. 10 years later, in a fit of rage, throws gasoline on partygoers in the Bronx and lights a nightclub on fire, killing 87 people. Who was this crazed maniac, and what brought him to such rage that he took the lives of 87 innocent souls? Today, the story of Julio Gonzalez and the Happy Land Fire on the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the Dark Side of Wikipedia.
Julio Gonzalez. A young man, just 26 years old. Most of his time was spent following others. He had been that way as far back as he could remember. When the guards kicked the prisoners out of their stinking cells that morning, he simply followed behind the people in front of him. But he hadn't committed any real crime on this occasion, that is. He simply told the police that he was a drug dealer so he could join the boat lift to leave Cuba. The guards marched him quickly through a forest towards a bay. A rolling surf pounded against the beaches with a familiar rhythm as they gathered at the edge of the sea to wait. They huddled into a dilapidated wooden dock that seemed to barely hold the crushing weight of hundreds of people. They stood in rows of threes as Castro's troops, their AK-47s held at the ready, hurried them along. "Vamanos, vamanos," the soldiers yelled as they pushed the helpless men and women towards the swaying boat at the end of the dock. The crowd moved quickly. They knew the soldiers would shoot them down like dogs at the first provocation. "Vamanos," he screamed as they beat the prisoners with long, flexible sticks held in one hand and drank cerveza with the other. Of course, these people didn't know they were going and didn't really care. Anything was better than a Cuban prison where there was no food, little water, and lots of issues. Some said they were headed for America, though none could really comprehend this. What government would be crazy enough to take in another country's criminals? Somewhere along this multitude, a young man who was wearing rags and hadn't eaten in 2 days glanced around him. He had dressed or deserted the Cuban army in the early 70s and spent 3 years in prison. He recognized some of these men since he had been in jail with them since 1974. They were thieves, drug addicts, mentally deranged, rapists, murderers, and worse. They were political prisoners, too. Castro's jail made no distinction between them and other common criminals. These people were the national flotsam of Cuba, the corrupted and depraved, the rejected and the homeless. They joined 100,000 other refugees who would soon risk life and limb to reach the shores of a magical country they could easily die to see. They were a small part of a larger group, a footnote to history. And although these prisoners represented less than 4% of the immigrants who arrived in America during this tumultuous period, this era would mostly be remembered as the time Fidel Castro emptied his jails and dumped Cuba's unwanted into Carter's lap. This ragtag exodus became known as the Freedom Flotilla, and these people were later called Los Mariletos. The crowd shuffled along the dock like so much cattle, until they were tossed on a boat deck by two powerfully built soldiers who alternately cursed and beat the prisoners between gulps of warm beer. The tropical heat was brutal. Several women fainted and were lying on the deck unattended as the frightened mass simply stepped over the bodies, eager to escape the swinging whips of the guards. The boat trembled as the shifting weight caused it to tilt dangerously to port. When it finally got underway, its ancient engine kicking and gasping for air, the boat seemed as if it would barely make it out of the Merrill Bay. But out to sea it went, northeast across the Azure Sea, on its perilous journey to the fabled country that for them existed only in their dreams. For most of these refugees, however, that dream would soon become a nightmare when they later found themselves languished for months and years in detention centers in Arkansas and Wisconsin, the pawns of bureaucratic red tape and the ever-shifting political winds. Barely 2 weeks later, on May 31st, 1980, in Key West, Florida, Julio Gonzalez, 25 years old, uneducated, impoverished, a military deserter in his own country, a man who so far had accomplished nothing in life, an ex-convict with no possessions and no future, arrived in America. It is the dark side of Wikipedia. And this is a story that I was really shocked to initially hear about for how horrible this thing ends up. And obviously we'll get to just how horrible it ends up. But just that I remember many horrible stories and learned about them even before the time I was born. This one I'd never, ever heard of. And with that many people dying in a horrific nightclub fire that was intentionally lit, I was just kind of shocked to hear this one. So I thought, well, this would be an interesting one to share with our audience on the dark side of Wikipedia. I'm Tony Bruschi, Sean with us today. Did you have any knowledge of this story at all or anything ever?
You know, I remember the one in France, I believe it was, like 5 years ago. Sure. But prior to that, I had not. I want to say there was something. It wasn't a criminal act. I think it was just a fire. Yeah. I want to say out in Northern California as well, or the Oakland area, as far as a mass casualty. But this, no. And what we think of this gentleman, definitely the... All too often we talk about what ingredients were in the initial recipe growing up from an early childhood. And this gentleman, wow, I don't anticipate him growing up to be a doctor of what we know of him thus far.
Yeah, I mean,
a social worker.
No, I mean, you look at this, I mean, you feel bad for individuals who have had such a horrible upbringing in life and all that. But at the same point, it's like the odds there, the recipes for disaster there, go up tremendously when that's the ingredients that you're given. And several, you know, break out of that and they don't go down that path. They don't go down that road. So you can't sit and, you know, judge anyone before it happens, but you want to be aware. And I guess most importantly, it ultimately goes back to the world of mental health and having availability for people to try and rescue themselves or others to try and help them. Not go down a horrible path when they've been given absolute shit ingredients. Essentially, like kind of the antidote to, you know, the poison that they've been drinking their whole lives. And obviously, in some cases, like we're reading about today, the antidote's never given. And what's the answer to that? You know, how does that work? It's not an easy solution by any means. Just speaking in very general terms, you know, that's where, if that was more readily available, I think you'd have less of those sort of issues that go on.
We all need that release.
Yeah.
People form it in exercise, some people in creating, some people in obviously 2020, all musicians who the amazement you feel when you go out on the road, you perform in front of thousands of people. Clearly it's been a rough year for so many, but just the human brain and us being as a whole to get to that feeling of that emotion. Some people go the route of murder to get what others get after they go for a 5 or 6 mile run, or those that redecorate their house or even make their bed or do laundry. Everybody has that thing. And as unique as we are, all of us throughout the world, some of us enjoy killing to have the same feeling that I would get of folding my clothes after I take them out of the dryer.
Yeah. I mean, I think it comes down to feeling. I think some people have been so damaged and been dealt such a shit hand that they naturally make bad decisions because that's all they know. And then they're just so numb to feeling anything, period. Good, bad, indifferent, happy, sad, whatever it may be. They're just numb to all of it, that it takes such extreme behavior for them to feel. That's where you get, you know, people with self-harm, because they just want to feel something. And some people take it beyond self-harm and they start harming others to feel something. And what feeling you get when you take your clothes out of your dryer, oh, great, dried clothes, just the small little lift. They're never getting that little lift. So the first time they get a taste of that little lift, but it was done by doing something horrible or heinous or harmful. And they discover that's the only way I get that feeling. I don't get it from the clothes out of the dryer. I don't get it from taking a run. I don't get it from whatever productive, positive activity they could get. And then they seek that out and they search that out. And then you get situations like this. Let's continue into the Julio Gonzalez and the Happyland Fire story here on the Dark Side of Wikipedia. And while you're listening, if you've not done so already, be sure to press subscribe wherever you are downloading podcasts so you don't miss any of our episodes. We have new episodes every single Monday and Tuesday. Best of on Wednesdays. And extras as well through Patreon. You can find more on that at darksideofwiki.com. Eventually, Julio Gonzalez made his way to New York City, where a large number of Los Marilitos seemed to gather. Through his sponsor, the American Council for Nationalities, he assimilated into the American society without incident. Later, he managed to secure a series of low-paying jobs, which gave him barely enough money to live on in one of the most expensive cities in America. He met a woman in 1984, Lydia Feliciano, who worked in a social club named Happyland in East Tremont section of the Bronx. Soon he moved into her apartment and for the next few years drifted along in anonymity, making new friends, barely surviving a living and living a life even with infinitely better than a life in Cuba. The area of East Tremont Avenue near Southern Boulevard in the Bronx is an area that has undergone a vast amount of ethnic, social, and economic change after the Second World War. Then a neighborhood of primarily Italian and Irish immigrants, it evolved into an African-American community during the late 1950s and 60s. During the 70s and 80s, the area became a vibrant business enclave for the Hispanic immigrants from Puerto Rico, Honduras, Ecuador, and Mexico. Each ethnic group maintained its own culture, traditions, and heritage in the form of social clubs along East Tremont Avenue, Southern Boulevard, and the surrounding neighborhoods. No one really knew how many existed since most of these clubs operated in violation of city ordinances that were designed to prevent such clubs to conduct business in an unsafe and illegal manner. Social clubs are usually located back from the street front locations, away from the prying eyes of police and inspectors who had the authority to shut these places down upon discovery. But on the weekend nights, these clubs would rock with the sounds of Morange, Carlos Santana, all variations of Latino music, and especially the legendary Tito Punet, a Bronx icon. Such a club was Happyland. The club was unique from the other bars in the Tremont neighborhood since it became the central meeting place for the Honduran community in the Bronx. These immigrants from Central America's poorest country also tended to be from the same region of Honduras, the northern border near Nicaragua. They came to America for the same reasons all other immigrants come, to seek a better life, escape grinding poverty, and chase the mythic American dream. Happyland catered to the Hondurans by supplying customers with the homeland beer and sponsoring a social or soccer team for neighborhood youth. Unlike the Puerto Ricans, who have a much larger presence in New York City, Hondurans maintained a more fragmented community than other ethnic groups. Illegal social clubs pulled them together and provided a center for all types of social activities. Located at 1959 Southern Boulevard, just off East Tremont Avenue, Happyland was a major attraction for the Honduran and Dominican communities in East Tremont. It was a place where immigrants could go to catch a glimpse of the old country, interact, and be with fellow countrymen and women. Happyland also sponsored a Little League baseball team. Baseball is a very popular sport in Central America and especially in the Dominican Republic. Chicago Cub Sammy Sosa, a Dominican native, is considered almost a god in his country. The club hosted many parties for the league players, and on weekends, Happyland was packed wall-to-wall with patrons who almost all knew each other by sight. "It's a connection to our culture," one customer told the newspapers. Time magazine reported on April 9, 1990, that over 1,000 such clubs existed in New York City. And March 25th, 1990, was the weekend of Punta Carnaval, which is the Honduran equivalent of Mardi Gras. Upstairs in the Happy Land bar, about 2:30 a.m. this early Sunday morning, Julio Gonzalez, the Cuban army deserter and ex-convict, was sitting with ex-girlfriend Lydia Feliciano, 45. Julio recently lost his job as a warehouseman at a lamp factory in Queens. He was having a hard time paying his rent and was reduced to hustling on the streets of the South Bronx. At the bar, he drank beer and argued with Lydia, who had been living with him on and off for 6 years. There were also words about Lydia's employment at the club. Julio wanted her to quit, and she refused. Lydia didn't want much to do with Gonzalez anymore and refused to take him back. She told him that she had lots of potential boyfriends. Her family had already pressured her to end the relationship, but Julio persisted until Lydia finally tried to leave him at the bar. He grabbed her, and a bouncer intervened. Somewhere around 3 a.m., when the bouncer intervened, Julio became angrier. "She's my woman, not yours," he screamed. That's the preview. If you want to hear the full episode, be sure to subscribe to Dark Side of Wikipedia wherever you download podcasts and get new episodes every Monday and Tuesday.